Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 68 of the Burden of Command podcast. This episode, I have another great guest from our folks over at C.S. Lewis Publicists and Company, Dr. Tara Peters. You're going to love this interview, especially if you are an entrepreneur, business owner, and you are struggling with what every other entrepreneur and business owner struggles with, employee engagement. Dr. Peters and her co-author, Dr. Bush, give you a lot of feedback, a lot of statistics, and a lot of valuable tools on how to turn those disengaged employees back into engaged employees and or find better engaged employees. But Dr. Peters says it best herself, so I'm not going to belabor the point right now, and I'm going to let you get right into this interview with Dr. Tara Peters. Well, hey everyone, and welcome to this episode of the Burden of Command podcast. Today's guest is one half of the authorship duo of the book, The Demotivated Employee, Helping Leaders Solve the Motivation Crisis That is Plaguing Business. Dr. Tara Peters is a gifted educator, TED Talk speaker, best-selling author, and international consultant with a client list that includes Coca-Cola, Allstate, Walmart, and Aquin. A professional educator for more than 26 years, she currently serves as a professor at Northwood University's Richard DeVos Graduate School of Management and is an academic dean for its Texas campus. As I mentioned before, she is the co-author of the new book with Dr. Kathy Bush titled The Demotivated Employee, Helping Leaders Solve the Motivation Crisis That is Plaguing Business. Dr. Peters, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Earl. I'm glad to be here.
Oh, I'm excited to get into this discussion because motivation and keeping employees going, especially in a kind of a virtual environment we're in right now in the midst of the COVID crisis, is a huge topic. So this is a very timely interview.
I would agree with you as well. And so certainly we've been having conversations about this, both internally, externally. So I'm looking forward to you and I having a chance to chat about that as well.
Well, absolutely. So before we get into that discussion, I want to start you off where I start everybody. When you hear the phrase, the burden of command, what does that mean to you?
So when I think about that phrase, one of the things that comes to mind is certainly there's a military connotation there. And while I didn't serve in the military, I certainly have great respect and admiration for those who have served and sacrificed for this country so that you and I enjoy the freedoms that we have. And I know that you've served in our armed forces as well. And so for me, what I really think about is just the responsibility that you have, because leadership really is about others. And understanding that responsibility, understanding the accountability that comes with it, and then being conscious of that in the choices that you are making, because the implications of those decisions really could be quite profound in terms of the people who are ultimately either going to have to execute that decision or who are going to be affected by it. So that's what I think about when I consider the burden of command.
Oh, no, I love that answer. And so kind of building on that, mentioning the military, you know, motivation was a big topic for us, but it showed its head in kind of the stereotypical, sometimes, if you will, screaming and yelling. I know in some organizations, they use motivation through incentives. And, you know, we've all heard about, you know, ping pong tables and all the fun stuff. And sometimes motivation is incentivized through monetary packages and all that. But what really is motivation?
So, of course, motivation has been, I mean, researched for decades now, and there's different schools of thought on it. And kind of the two big buckets are intrinsic and extrinsic motivation. So the extrinsic piece being the things you kind of talked about around monetary incentives, bonuses, payouts, the kinds of things that we tend to reach for in terms of trying to cause people to be energized and to give effort towards the work that has to be done. And then the flip side of that is really say, okay, motivation is not a function of external factors, but it really really starts from within. It comes from, it resides within the person. And it also has a premise that you and I actually own our motivation. And so you and I decide what are the levers, if you will cause us to want to give the extra effort, that will cause us to be committed to the work and to engage in a way that allows the organization to get to the designated outcomes. And really, Kathy and I, really, because we've been in higher education for 20 plus years, and we've been in industry for even longer, we really have come to the place that we believe that intrinsic motivation is really where we need to focus our efforts. It doesn't mean that we ignore pay, because you can certainly affect people's motivation if you don't pay them fairly, and if you don't pay them in a way that allows them to meet their personal and physical needs that they might have, to create security, et cetera. So pay does have a place, but you can't expect that continuing to pay people and extending monetary bonuses or other types of incentives over time are really going to cause people to maintain their motivation. They can have a temporary benefit, but it's not longstanding. And so we have really focused our energy and really our writing and efforts around really focusing in on intrinsic motivation.
Okay. No, that's a great way of putting it and great way of looking at it. So I guess the big place to start here, and this is where y'all start in the book, what happened to employee motivation?
So it's a great question, right?
It really is. It really is.
And when we think about it, really what it really started from, so Kathy and I were teaching, and we taught in the DeVos Graduate School, and we were teaching in the MBA program. And so, of course, people come back to school to work on an MBA because they're professional, they're in industry, and they want to climb the corporate ladder, or they want to start their own business. So they're aspirational in terms of what they want to do. And so we were having conversations, and we would, hear these, highly talented, clearly capable individuals talking about how they had lost their motivation. They would go on to, talk about what had actually transpired that had resulted in them feeling that way. And so Kathy and I said, okay, we really need to drill down on this to try to better understand what is it that's happening. Because you and I can remember when we first started our job, right? We were excited. We were like, oh my God, I have this new job, this new opportunity. I'm super excited. I can't wait to join the organization. I'm going to be working with these amazing people. I'm going to, really get to use my gifts and my strengths to the and bring those to the organization and really help to drive performance or whatever objectives the organization is trying to achieve. And so we were all gung-ho. We were ready to go. And then we got in there. And then something happened to us, right? And it might have just been a little thing. It might have been that you were in a meeting and your idea was dismissed. It might have been that maybe you got some adverse feedback. And so, that kind of punched a little hole in your basket. Or maybe, you had a lot going on at work, you were really stressed. And so, that had an impact on you. But over time, you and I survive. We use this analogy in the book of a basket analogy. Things happen at work. And so we get holes punched in our basket, and little holes you and I will recover from. So we have a disappointment, we have a setback, we're typically resilient, we'll come back from that. But over time, if we continue to be punched in terms of our motivational basket, if we have situations that persist over time, it can cause you and I to actually be deflated. And people who were once highly engaged, highly committed to the work are suddenly dragging into work, are suddenly no longer contributing in meetings, or suddenly missing work and not able to be fully present. And so really trying to understand that, we think is important, because there's a financial consequence when you think about that, going from that employee who was super excited about doing the work to someone who's now no longer excited, no longer engaged. What's that individual like when they're interacting with your customers? Mm-hmm. You want them talking to your new client? What's that individual like when they're in meetings and you're trying to work on a new product development? Are they fully present, engaged, giving their ideas? So when you and I think about that, just from a leadership perspective, we really want to try to get to the bottom of it and understand, to the original question, what happened to their motivation?
Yeah, no, I mean, that's and there's a lot. I mean, like we touched on already, there's a lot of things that could happen to demotivate an employee, and they're not always obvious. And what I liked about what you your basket analogy there is there's a thing that, my partner and I, we kind of marry diversity, inclusion, and leadership together. And we talk about a very similar concept. In psychology, they call it moral injury, right? And it has the same exact effect as what you're talking about. It's these when something that is valued by the employee and that an organization states, this is just one small example, states that it's valuable to them, and then they act counter to that, you've violated like a deeply held belief for that individual, and you've created this moral injury. And like you said, one or two you can withstand, but eventually they build up and you can create a complete moral break. And sometimes that leads to quitting. But one of the ways that manifests is through a demotivated employee. They're checked out of work. They're not as gung-ho, like you said. And I like the way that you tie that in there with that kind of bottom line, because it does. It has a huge impact. Are you familiar with Zappos?
Yes. Uh-huh. Right. Yes, we love Zappos. We talk about their culture because we think it's really they kind of become really a model for what you would actually want. So yeah, so talk some more about Zappos.
Well, yeah, no, I mean, and going tying into the bottom line piece there, it's so important to them, and I think they still do this. They actually pay an employee to leave at the end of the training cycle because it costs them less money to pay somebody to leave than to keep somebody on board that doesn't want to be there. So I don't know what your experiences are with that. Is that a tactic that y'all think is worthy of looking at for other organizations, or what are your thoughts on that?
So here's what I would say. I think the idea that you want people who are going to fit not just with the role, but also with the culture, I think is important. And so whether that is the way that Zappos does this, which is where the training happens and then the employee has a decision to make whether or not this is a good fit or not, I think hiring for fit and bringing people on board that will match not only just in terms of the skills, but also the culture of the organization. So whether that's a clan culture or market culture, we talk about this in the book. Culture represents certain values and preferences that people have for work. And so you want to make sure that when you're joining an organization, that those values and those preferences that you have for the work environment that you're going to be engaged in and committed to are actually going to suit your preferences and your tendencies. And so, because that has all kinds of implications, kind of going back to the point that we were talking about earlier, where how we fully commit to the work, how we are perhaps more likely to stay or to leave, because we can still be present but already gone. And that is expensive for organizations. And so, there's some interesting work on this that Gallup has been doing for now 20 years, where they've looked at with their Q12 employee engagement and have estimated that the cost of employees being disengaged, and they talk about two categories, those who are disengaged, they're checked out, right? They're just doing barely enough. And then those actively disengaged folks, they're engaged in deviant behaviors, that's 70% of your workforce. So think about that. I mean, that's staggering that you've got 10 employees and 7 out of them are in some category of being disengaged. And you're paying for that.
Right.
Your customers are paying for that. And so why would we continue to do this? And Kathy and I say it's illogical that we would do that. And we don't believe that companies are intentionally, having a workforce that is, 70% or approaching 70%, being disengaged. And again, there's variability around that, but there's just kind of a bottom line that they have identified in terms of their research. And so really, so how do we help companies so that, to go back to the Zappos illustration that you gave, that employee who decides that, yes, that Zappos is a place that I want to be, that same energy, that same commitment and motivation that the employee had when they said yes, that they keep that throughout the duration of their employment, because it has all kinds of implications for the bottom line. Again, looking at potentially this, $500 billion cost annually to companies, to the costs that are, and that's a productivity connection, but the cost also associated with turnover. And so we think it's really, really important to look at that and to figure out what is going to work for the individual organization in terms of how they ensure that fitness is there.
No, that's an outstanding outstanding answer there, and hopefully that explanation answered kind of what chapter two is. I'm kind of going down the chapters in the book a little bit here for the listeners. I really encourage you all to pick up a copy of this book because you know, the doctors have really, they've laid the book out beautifully, in my opinion. I like the way towards the end of each chapter, and I like all books that are laid out like this. You've got the kind of the leadership actions that you can take, and then you've got a little note section there for reflection. And I really like the way y'all laid that out. That is a very handy tool that you put in the book. But y'all kind of identified five sources of employee demotivation. And kind of going down the list here, the first one is individual differences. Talk about that, please.
So when we were looking at the research, so kind of give a little context, it took Kathy and I about a year and a half to actually write the book. So we spent a lot of time reading, a lot of time researching, and to further inform our own professional experiences in terms of what we were seeing. And so what we found in our research were these five sources: individual differences, we're going to talk about stress, organizational culture, conflict with coworkers, and then leadership style. And we say in the book, this list is not exhaustive. There are other factors, but based upon the research and again, our professional experience, these were the five primary sources that we really wanted to focus in on. And so when we were looking at individual differences, this is really about you and I. And out of the five sources, it's the one that is owned entirely by the individual. So what do I mean by that? So we talk about individual differences. One of the areas that we talk about is personality. So are you introverted? Are you extroverted? Are you open to experience or not? Do you have high levels of emotional stability or not? So we spend some time in the book talking about the big five personality traits, because there are roles that are better suited to you and I in terms of how we are hardwired. And sometimes those roles change. So maybe we were, for example, we were working as a researcher, and so that was highly stimulating to us as an introvert. It was great for us in terms of what our preferences were for how we would work and then how we could provide value to the organization. But as happens, we get tapped on the shoulder. Somebody says, wow, you know, Tara's a really good researcher. And so, you know what? We'd like for her to lead the team of researchers now. That's a very different role. Right. That becomes more public facing. That requires you now to be responsible for other people. And now I'm pulling on a part of your personality that is really not one of your preferences. You're now having to interact with people. You're now having to build relationships and to make connections. And for an introvert, that may become exhausting over time. And so this wonderful work that you once enjoyed now is less stimulating for you. It's actually tiring for you. It's actually draining you. And so personality does play a role. And personality isn't something that you and I can really do much about. It's kind of hardwired in the DNA, and it's kind of, it is what it is. So as a leader, what we say is, while you can't necessarily change a person's personality, you can be conscious of that and then to put them in positions that are better suited to their personality preferences. Or if it's going to be in a situation where there might be some discomfort, then you provide support and training that will help to increase the likelihood of that individual being successful in that new role that is leveraging a part of their personality that is perhaps not their preferred method. So we recognize individual differences are important. We also talk about, you know, competence. And boy, have we all been learning a lot during COVID.
yes.
And having to change our way of doing things. And so, of course, I'm in education. And so you can imagine in higher ed, there was an article on Bloomberg some months ago saying that 70% of faculty in higher ed had never taught online. So imagine suddenly all these faculty who have, they're comfortable in their classroom spaces, right? They know how to navigate that. They are in their element. And now those same faculty members now have to move online, which is a brand new space. The tools and the design looks very different than it does in the classroom. And now these highly capable, you know, credentialed, you know, just top tier professionals are now struggling
Right.
Because they don't know how to do something or they're not very good at it. And so competence is something that you and I struggle with. And if the leader doesn't come in to provide support, to help the employee to get past that discomfort that comes with not knowing how to do something and helping them to get up to speed more quickly and then supporting them, that can cause that employee to be demotivated. And so we recognize that individuals, you and I, have control over our demotivation. There are certain parts of that that you and I own completely, but we say to leaders, you don't get a free pass. You can't abdicate responsibility and say, oh, that's just Tara's personality. No. What can I do understanding that to help to support her?
Yeah. No, I love that because it's so close to, one of the things I say, and I preface this, I say, this is probably the most controversial thing you're going to hear me to say today. When a project succeeds, the team succeeded. When the project fails, the leader failed. And it's this exact thing right here, right? You put somebody, chances are you put somebody in the wrong place. Chances are you completely misidentified what somebody's strengths or weaknesses were. Maybe you miscommunicated it, the whole nine yards. But the one thing that I like about what you just said, and we have to point out at that point ourselves, is especially in a time like what you're looking at here now, when you have, say, it's a tech space or even in education, you have educators who are used to doing it, quote, the traditional way, and now you're forced to do it a different way. Sometimes you have to step back and look at that newer educator that may be more used to doing things that way and give them an opportunity to help bring everybody along, because that's a big problem that the millennial generation went through and subsequent generations are going to go through, is that wasn't happening, which is what led to a big portion of that, changing jobs every 3 years. There were times for their skills to shine and they were kind of being pushed to the back. You haven't paid your dues. You haven't proved your value. But if you embrace them and bring them forward, you can keep them motivated because they feel like they're a valuable part of the team, right?
Absolutely. And so, one of the things that leaders have to think about, to your point, is how do we allow people to bring their strengths to the table every day in the organization? And let that be one of the guiding principles that you and I embrace as we're looking at our team, the dynamics, and the importance of getting to the objective. And so recognizing that, I think, is really, really important, because when people can't really utilize their skill sets and their capabilities, then like anything else, they're likely to become disenchanted and say, okay, I'm going to take my talents elsewhere. And what a loss for the organization. What a loss for the team members that really could have learned from that millennial. And I go to bat for millennials because my son is a millennial. He's an older one. But millennials have so much to give when you tap into their interests, when you tap into their values. They will really fully engage and commit and support. But you have to find what their levers are and then bring them into the fold. And that requires you and I as leaders to figure out how we might need to manage differently than perhaps we might have managed other generations. Because in this tech-savvy world, I'll take a millennial and I'll take a Gen Zer every day. Because their capabilities are so integral to the work that the organization is going to be doing. Now, by the same token, they can also learn from those who have a set of experiences. Because honestly, there is no substitute for experience.
Right.
There are just some things that you've got to learn because you've done them. And there's a trial and error component. But putting millennials into positions where they can have those experiences causes them to be engaged, allows them to learn, and then to allow those who work with them to learn as well.
Yeah. Well, and I'll just say this is kind of a word of caution, because, we kind of talked about it earlier. Why do leaders need to solve the motivation crisis? The danger that organizations are in right now is when you disengage that employee to the point where they're ready to take their talents elsewhere, as Tara just said, you never know when that individual is the one that's going to go out and create the startup that puts you out of business, right?
Absolutely.
That's the advantage that I'll just say younger generations, to catch millennial and everybody, they have, is they have a lot more opportunities than we did, thanks to technology. So it's a scary, you're kind of playing Russian roulette with not paying attention to motivation, because you could be demotivating an employee out the door to put you out of business.
Exactly. And so it really becomes this, you know, strategic perspective taking that's required of leaders, and not to be short-sighted in the choices that they're making, but to take the long-term view. And I know sometimes that can be challenging, particularly when if you're a publicly traded company and there's this constant, you know, barrage of reporting and analysts and the chasing of stock price and other things that can cause individuals to be short-sighted in terms of the decisions that they are making. But I go back to, you know, to Jeff Bezos when Amazon was being criticized for some of the choices that Bezos was making. And he basically responded back that he was not running the company for the market. And he was making strategic choices that would pay off in the long run. And I think it's hard to argue, given where Amazon is right now, that Bezos wasn't actually right. And so to your point, really being able to think about what are the implications of the choices that we're making, so that we don't run off really good and talented people that could eventually, you know, become our competitors, because Amazon plays in a lot of spaces. And so, you know, companies have got to stay relevant, because if they don't, someone else is there to take their spot.
That's exactly it. So the next one on the list, stressful work. You know, we're in the midst of COVID-19. We've got all sorts of civil unrest breaking out across the country. Every time you turn on the news, there's something else that seems to be happening. You know, we're in 2020, and there's this new thing, you know, with what's the disaster of the month going to be? So we're in a very high-stress environment right now. Add on to that a stressful workplace, I imagine, and you are kind of primed for a demotivated employee, right?
I would absolutely agree with that. And if you think about it, even if you had an employee who wasn't necessarily demotivated before COVID, they were, you know, things were going well for them. They were happy with their experiences at work, how they were contributing, how they were, you know, working on projects, et cetera. But now their life has changed. Perhaps they've been personally impacted by COVID. We've got over 185,000 Americans who have died from the disease, more than 6 million infected. So maybe they've been personally impacted by COVID, or maybe their work-life situation has changed. So their kids are home, so they've got new coworkers, or their spouse is home. And so they're trying to manage those dynamics as well. And so all of that then is compounded, because you and I, we don't live in a bubble. We are a part of the world. We are a part of what's going on in America. And so you superimpose that on top of what we might be dealing with at work. And really, we have a recipe potentially for disaster if leaders and organizations are not proactive in their stance. And so one of the things that Kathy and I talk about in the book is that stress cuts both ways. And so what do we mean by that? So there can be some short-term benefits to stress. You and I, we've all had this experience. We have this deadline. We got a paper to write, whatever that has to be done, or a client deadline that has to be met. So we're pedaling really, really hard to get there. And then we exhale, like, oh my gosh, we did that. And we're super proud of ourselves. And we pat ourselves on the back. That kind of stress, that's okay. Short period of time, it's a short burst. It came and it went. Where stress becomes problematic is when it returns frequently and it's ongoing and sustained, because then it can lead to health implications around you and I perhaps having issues with, you know, heart disease, you and I having cardiovascular issues that arise from that. So stress does have health implications, but also the implications for the workplace. When you and I are stressed, not only is our productivity impacted, but that impacts you and I actually being present. So we may be more likely to be absent or to call in. And so we really have to think about stress and what it means in the workplace. And in this time, paying attention to stress with your employees is consequential. I'll kind of give you an example of this. I've been in on meetings, and you can tell that one of your coworkers is actually stressed by their body language. You can tell that they're stressed by the comments that they make. And I think what's really important as a leader is to not only hear that individual and to see them, but to respond to that. And so one of the things that I've done with my own staff is to, once I recognize that, is I actually, once we're done with that meeting, I actually then pick up the phone and call and have a one-on-one conversation just to say, hey, just want to chat with you, you know, for a few minutes. I could see from your face, I could see from X, Y, and Z. And we talk about this in the book around managers really sitting down with employees to say, okay, let's talk about what's going on. Let's talk about how I might be able to step in, to pitch in, to help. It doesn't mean that you and I can actually take away the stressor, because the situation may be just what it's going to be because of the circumstances, particularly around COVID. But when people know that you care about them, Earl, and you know this, people really internalize that. And it helps them to maybe exhale for a moment, sit down with you, and in a really thoughtful way, come up with how you can then proceed, how you can move forward. And so I would really encourage leaders during this time to make sure that you're really having touch points with your people. And I know sometimes, particularly if you're managing large groups of people, if you have, you know, hundreds of people that you're managing, that can be a little more difficult in order to do that. But think about how you can actually personalize those interactions. And it might be just that, how quickly could you send a quick email just to check in? That may be more efficient than, you know, trying to call hundreds of people. I get that. But you and I being intentional so that people know that we actually care about them, and then actually not just saying that, but actually demonstrating that.
I mean, that word care, I mean, it's such a small word, but it has such a huge impact. I mean, I love everything you just said, and it's weird to me, being a Marine, you know, as you mm-hmm. mentioned, my background is in the Marine mm-hmm. Corps, and that care and concern was a central column of Marine Corps leadership. You know, we had this saying, the two primary missions of the Marine Corps are mission accomplishment and troop welfare, not or, and troop welfare. Because you had to take care of the troops to get the mission accomplished. And every great leader knew that. And so it always boggles my brain that an organization that is known as the few, the proud, the Marines, and the world's toughest fighting organization, and all these things that we say about the Marine Corps, all true, by the way.
Absolutely.
but we've put caring for our people as a central column of our leadership abilities. But when you go into a civilian organization, you start talking about care and concern, and heaven forbid you actually use the L word and talk about how you should love your employees. Mm-hmm. It's like you're telling them to kick puppies, right?
It's amazing, to your point. And it's one of my favorite authors and researchers is Jim Koutsis. And he actually endorsed our book, and Kathy and I had the chance to interview Jim a few months ago, and he has on his email, you'll see this tagline, love them and lead them. And he tells this story in his book, The Leadership Challenge, with Barry Posner, about this story of a general that shares, you know, basically what's the secret. And the secret sauce is loving your employees. Mm-hmm. And it's so simple. And again, you don't expect to hear that from someone in the military. It's like, he's going to say something, but it's not going to be that. But he recognized how the importance of loving your people, and that genuine love, which embodies care and empathy and concern for them, how that mattered, how that was the differentiator. And to think that leaders don't necessarily embrace that philosophy and more importantly, practice it, really becomes just a point of kind of consternation from my vantage point. And I would think you would probably agree with me with why we don't attend to that. Loving doesn't mean that you can't still create accountability. Parents do this every single day. We love our kids to life, but when they don't follow the rules or there's a consequence, we dole that out. We create the accountability. So the two are not mutually exclusive. They do coexist, but how important it is that people know that. And so I really love that on Jim's whole tagline with love them and lead them. And if we do that as leaders in organizations, imagine just the impact that we would have on our employees and then our department and then ultimately the organization more broadly.
Oh, yeah. No, it was so the way the Marines work with leadership development is as you progress through the ranks, you have to go to subsequent schools. You have to go to a corporal's course. You have to go to a sergeant's course and such on and so forth. And I had an instructor in one of those. He said, the perfect definition for Marine Corps leadership is this. You have to be professional enough to be able to train your troops for any situation they could come up against, up to and including death, and be ready to send them into that situation. But you have to love them so much that the idea of doing it rips your heart out.
And that says so much, right, about the role of the leader, so much about the character of the leader. And, you know, it just really embodies what I believe leadership really is philosophically. It is so much about other people. And going back to the point that you raised earlier, that recognizing the importance of the team, recognizing the importance of those who are following you, understanding that has all kinds of implications in terms of you actually achieving the mission and getting to the goal, because those two have to come together in order for you to be successful. Because the leader in and of, you know, himself or herself cannot do it alone. They've got to have the team on board. And so really, I love that whole illustration there that you gave with the whole training. And it also goes back to really your opening question about the burden of command. And so recognizing the real consequence of the choices that I'm making, and to care so much about my people that I want to protect them to whatever extent possible. And if harm is going to be a potential outcome, that I struggle with that. And I obviously want to try to mitigate it. And I was sharing the story the other night I teach in our MBA program, and so I had a group of students in their second leadership class, and one of the things I was sharing with them when we were talking about is, you know, in a civilian context, we aren't typically faced with decisions of life and death. They don't come up unless we are in certain kinds of professions, for example, healthcare. But on a day-to-day basis, for many of us in industry, that's not the case. But when you think about COVID right now, the choices that we make have the potential for life and death implications. And so really thinking about our stakeholders, thinking about our students, thinking about our faculty, thinking about our, you know, ancillary support services staff, you know, are we making choices that represent what you and I talked about here, right? Caring about the team, recognizing the importance of the team, and balancing that against the need to achieve, right, whatever the outcomes and objectives that we have. And it has really come home for me during this time about really how consequential our choices can be.
Well, and yes, absolutely. And, you know, we've kind of, we haven't really kind of said it, but we've been kind of talking about number three on that list of five. Organizational culture. That's really kind of what we've been talking about. Mm-hmm. And I think we've done a pretty good job of illustrating why organizational culture is important to motivating or demotivating an employee. But you and I talk about it more from the motivation standpoint. I want to really ask this question correctly. What is wrong with corporate organizations right now that is leading to this demotivation crisis?
So one of the things that I would say is in terms of culture, you know, culture starts at the top. Leadership sets the tone. We hear that all the time. And we may very well embrace that philosophy ourselves. But one of the things that organizations struggle with is setting an appropriate tone from the top that actually cascades down throughout the organization. One of the things that Kathy and I talk about in the book, we talk about this early on, is we are not cynics. So we don't believe that a leader wakes up in the morning, brushing their teeth, stand in the mirror saying, let me see how I can stick it to Earl today.
Despite what Earl might think, that doesn't happen.
Right. We're really, really not doing that. And so what we say is really leaders are doing things out of ignorance. They're doing things unintentionally. They are not aware. They don't know that what they're actually doing is causing employees to be demotivated or causing employees to have holes punched in their motivational basket. And so really, that's what we talk about in this book, is to really equip leaders so that they are behaving in ways or not behaving in ways that will cause employees to be demotivated. And so one of the things that I would argue in this point in time that culture can impact right now is information flows. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that's really critical right now is whether it's good news, bad news, or something in between, leaders need to be over-communicating. Because when you don't communicate, you create a vacuum.
Yes.
And what happens is, you may have heard this phrasing, making stuff up. Some people use another, more colorful piece of language with the stuff. But that's what people do. It becomes MSU. Yeah. And so instead of going down that path, let's over-communicate with people and let's tell people what's going on. People can handle the truth as long as they know what the truth is. And what leaders need to understand is, just because you don't say it or you don't talk about it doesn't mean that employees are not talking about it. So over-communicate. Make sure that information is not just cascading down in the organization, but information is flowing up. So you created mechanisms where people at all levels in your organization can actually share information. And then you are actually taking that information and then utilizing it to inform the choices that you are making. Or if you can't, then you cycle back and you say, thank you for that information, but here's why we can't do that. Or here's how we've already perhaps maybe already accounted for that. And I'll say, one of the things that, you know, my institution is doing is we are having daily communications that are coming out from our communication office to say, okay, here's an update. Here's what's going on. That's happening every single day. And then we have a weekly huddle, which happens. So you have senior leadership with a weekly huddle on Tuesday afternoons, and it's a 15-minute meeting. So these are not long. These are quick updates, about 5 minutes of updates, and then 10 minutes for Q&A, and then people can go back. And so one of the things that we did in this last meeting was to talk about an update on the COVID cases, because if you open for business, you're going to have COVID cases. And so, and people know it. So people are guessing. What are people guessing? Do we have any COVID cases? No. So what should you do? You should tell them what the status is. You not telling them doesn't mean that they aren't having the conversation and thinking about it. But what they're doing, because you didn't tell them, is they're making stuff up. And so communication, when we think about culture, is so important right now. So if I was going to give any piece of advice right now to someone in a leadership position, it would be to over-communicate with your people. They'll tell you eventually, you know, okay, that's too much. But you'd rather have that than people saying to you, we're not hearing from you. We don't know what's going on. And so I think that should really be a priority right now for organizational leaders.
No, I like that a lot. Because two things, you know, one, you're 100% right. And like you kind of said, the stuff that people make up, it's never positive, and it's always worse than it really is. Like you said with COVID cases, you know, if you don't acknowledge it or somebody catches wind that there has been COVID cases, you know, maybe you had two, but they're like, oh, I heard we had 37 people.
Right. And 200 are quarantined.
Exactly. But what you said there about communication, it reminds me of a quote I heard from William Ury. He wrote Get to Yes and a couple of other books. Uh-huh. But he made a comment. He said, just about the time you are tired of communicating a message to your team, they're just starting to listen.
I have to laugh out loud on that, because I'm like, that is so true. Because, you know, it, we think that when we tell employees something one time that they got it.
Right.
And that they fully processed it and they know exactly what we mean and what we're doing. But to your point, it doesn't work that way. People, they heard a part of it and then not the rest of it. Or maybe they didn't hear anything. And it was the fourth time you said it that it registered. So that's pretty funny, but so true.
Yeah. Well, no. So kind of tying some of this together, we're conflict between coworkers. So you've got individual differences. Got a stressful work environment. You got a, let's just say, questionable organizational culture. Communication may or may not be the best. People are filling stuff in with worst case scenario stuff, which increases the stressful work environment, which does further damage the organizational culture and individual differences. It's, these things kind of start a cycle there, right?
Mm-hmm. And a vicious cycle.
and ultimately, you're going to have two coworkers that are on opposite ends of the spectrum, or even on opposite ends of one particular piece of the spectrum of the organization, or even a personal issue, that have conflicts. How does that affect everything?
So it's interesting because, you know, culture actually has an impact in terms of how we actually deal with conflict inside of the organization. One of the things that Kathy and I talk about in the book is we say, okay, there are four cultures that we actually, you know, take a look at in the research. It's based on some work by Cameron and Quinn in 2011. So there's clan, autocracy, hierarchy, and market. And so it goes back to an early part of our conversation where, you know, we were talking about fit. And so people have preferences. And so assuming that those preferences have been met, you've brought together, you know, a group of people who actually want to be in the organization and who fit culturally. What's interesting is that we know that when we bring individuals together and we ask them to work on teams or to be a part of a project or to join a functional area, they are not a monolithic group. They have different perspectives. They have different backgrounds. They have different ways of doing work. And so conflict is really a natural part of work. It comes about, you've done work on diversity and inclusion, and I know you talk about differences in terms of cognitive thinking, right? And so when that happens, conflict is going to be an inherent part of what happens in the organization. But culture impacts how people view conflict. Is conflict something to be avoided or something to be embraced? Is conflict something that when it comes up, we put it on the employees and we say, you guys go and figure that out, that's your problem? Or are there steps that the leader has taken or tries to take to help to mitigate that? And so one of the things that we really talk about in the book is around these views of conflict, and there's some interesting research around this. I kind of mentioned one of them. This whole avoidance view is basically a traditionalist view where, you know, conflict is bad.
Right.
And it's to be avoided at all costs. And sometimes in your organization, that's a prevailing view. You know, when someone brings up a differing point of view, we squash that. We don't really want to hear that, you know, it's everybody line up and agree to the direction that we're going in, because we don't want to deal with the potential challenge that comes with these dissenting points of view and then having to navigate that. But conflict, when it's healthy, can actually be quite functional. Because it leads to this great conversation. I mean, I love a good debate. Mm-hmm. And so I enjoy being in a conversation where we're using data and not personal opinions to actually talk through a potential course of action and the rationale and listening and doing that perspective taking. And I've found so many times in my own work that we actually get to a better outcome than we would have if we had not had that difficult conversation. And I just had one of these the other day, and then my colleague and I, we picked up the phone, and he was like, that was kind of messy. And I was like, yeah, it was. I was like, but it was so productive. He's like, you're absolutely right. And I said, we're used to those kinds of messy conversations, but you know why we're accustomed to them? Because we have a culture that allows for people to dissent. We have a culture that allows for people to bring a contrary viewpoint, but to disagree, but not to be disagreeable. So we have ground rules for how we're actually going to engage in those conversations. And so one of the things that we talk about in the book is that you are going to have conflicts with employees, and again, kind of a couple buckets here, task conflict. So I think that we ought to do 1, 2, 3. You think that we ought to do 4, 5, and 6. So we're disagreeing about how the work ought to be done. That's commonplace. Or maybe you and I, maybe our relationship is struggling. All right. Maybe we were working on a project together, and maybe you said something, or maybe you took credit for an idea that was mine. And so, you know, now I've got this issue, air quotes, if you could see me, with Earl. And instead of, you know, talking to you about and reconciling that issue, it's just kind of it's festered. And, you know, now we've got other people. Now I've got other people involved in it. And so the question becomes, how does the organization handle that? Well, hopefully, leaders have empowered employees that, and we teach this in our MBA program, if Earl and Tara have an issue, let's have Earl and Tara talk about it. But you have to train people, you have to equip them with how to have that difficult conversation. Because some people are predisposed to, I don't want to have that tough conversation. I don't want to bring up the topic because it makes me uncomfortable. I might have to hear something or say something that I really don't want to deal with, but we can help people to get more comfortable with resolving conflict. And so training people so that Earl and Tara can resolve it, because if you don't address it, it's not like it's not impacting other people, because everybody knows that Earl and Tara have an issue. And now the other employees are actually talking about it and perhaps taking sides. So, mm-hmm. You know, people are on my side, people on your side. That is not healthy for the group. And so equipping employees to deal with it directly, or if the employees can't mitigate it, then you as the leader actually stepping in to say, okay, we got to get to the bottom of this, right? And then figuring out with the employees that are having the issue what the next steps are. And so this may be as simple as sitting down to have a conversation with the employees. And it might be a separate conversation, right? So, you know, in terms of how you do it. But the point is that you opened up the dialogue, and then you're using that as a way to move forward towards resolution. And so that really becomes important. We think about the fact that conflict, again, has a place in organization. It's gonna happen, but you want to make sure that it's functional as opposed to dysfunctional. And when you let conflict go and you don't address it, it actually becomes dysfunctional.
Mm. No, I love that. I mean, I got nothing to add. I mean, yeah, being a Southerner myself, I'm just over here saying preach, right? So, you nailed it. But so, number 5 on the list, and this is a word you and I have both used quite a bit today during this conversation, leadership styles. How do leadership styles demotivate people?
So leadership styles, and, you know, there's many of them out there, anywhere from, these behavioral theories to, situational, they're all out there. And we talk about, servant leadership and a democratic style and affiliative style and coercive style and all of that. So there's all these kinds of styles. So basically it's about how people behave. So leadership at the end of the day is about what you and I do. It's the behaviors that we engage in. And what's interesting is what we talk about in the book is looking at how leaders behave, and we've identified 6 important behaviors. And what we say around these behaviors is that when leaders don't do these things, so we talk about them as failures, here are the consequences. And so I'll kind of talk about them really quickly here. But when you don't explain the why, and basically the idea being here is that you need to tell people where they're going. Mm-hmm. You need to cast a vision. Be clear about it, so that people understand in their day-to-day activity how what they are doing actually contributes, so that they can row in concert with what you are trying to accomplish. And if you think about that, just how important that messaging really is in terms of your employees. And there's a story that's told about, basically there was a janitor that was working on, working with NASA. And so, working on the project, to send John Glenn in his face. And so, you know, a reporter asked him, you know, well, what's your job? And he responds and says, send a man to the moon. You know, so the janitor, right?
That easy, right?
Yeah, exactly. So think about that. The janitor understood that everything that he was doing as a part of his work was tied to, was aligned with this end objective, right? This vision that had been cast that we were going to, you know, send a man to the moon. And so helping organizations to and leaders to really do that is important. We talked about this earlier, the failure to communicate frequently and clearly. Again, if you don't communicate, if you don't tell people what's going on, they will, they have a grapevine and it is real. And it lives. And it will communicate in your absence. And so we talk about how important that is. The failure to invite input and opinions. One of the worst mistakes that you can make is not to ask your people to get their perspective. And don't do it because people are smart and they're going to figure out this very quickly. Don't do it to say that you did it as a check the box and you really didn't intend to do anything with what they had to say. Do it with purpose. You really want to hear from them. And then take those things that you can and implement them or adopt them as a part of your decision. And if you can't, then it's this whole idea of closing the feedback loop. So going back to say, we had this idea and this input, but we couldn't do it because of X, Y, and Z, or we may be able to do it in a certain period of time under these conditions, but you let people know and you do it purposefully. You really want to hear from people and then you're going to do something with it. Providing effective feedback in coaching. You got to let people know how they are doing. And don't, and it's not enough just to do the annual review. Everybody knows that that is just a check the box kind of event. Yep. Right. Feedback should be ongoing. And that can be as simple as popping into your office and I stop by and they say, hey, Earl, you got a few minutes? And you say, sure, Tara. And I say, hey, Earl, just want to let you know, did an amazing job on that project. When I look at the quality of how you actually, you know, put together the PowerPoint deck for them, for the client, how you answered their questions, how you anticipated potential, you know, pushback from them, right? So I'm giving you specific feedback. It's actually actionable. It's something you can do about it. It's timely. So giving that feedback is really, really important. Then it makes it less difficult when you have to deliver the corrective feedback. I tell people all the time, when you, even though we are adults, every time that you have that performance conversation with your employee, you ask them to come to your office, they think that they are going to the principal's office. They are 50 years old and they still feel like they're going to the principal's office. So building that relationship before these kinds of formal interactions have to take place. Again, I know performance management is important, but it can't just be at the annual review. Then we talk about removing obstacles. So employees have barriers that they have to navigate. Help to remove them. Your people want to work. So one of the big barriers with moving to this remote work environment was people having access to technology. Can they VPN in? You know, do we have the video conferencing software? Are people comfortable with that? So those are obstacles. And so you have to remove those obstacles. You have to remove those barriers so that people can give their energy to the work. And then you fail to adjust your leadership style. So you manage people with a one-size-fits-all approach. Or every situation that comes up, you think it's a nail, therefore you use a hammer. And this inability to adjust is really consequential because there's a lot of research around situational leadership and basically trying to match the skills in terms of the employee to the situation that you're faced with. And so you as a leader, you need to be able to do that. And I tell students all the time, it doesn't come to you like a multiple choice test. You've got to be able to recognize it in the moment and then respond accordingly. And sometimes you're going to get it right. And then sometimes you're going to go back and you're going to say, dang it, I should have done. But guess what? That's a learning experience too. And so we really talk about these six behaviors, failure to explain the why, failure to communicate frequently and clearly, failure to invite input and opinions, failure to provide effective feedback and coaching, failure to remove obstacles, and failure to adjust leadership styles. When you don't do these things, you can cause your employees to lose their motivation. And so what we're saying to leaders is you need to do these things so that that doesn't happen to your employees.
Mm. No, that was outstanding. And you know, as crazy as it is, we're coming up on an hour here already. And I think you and I could probably talk the rest of the day on this. But
I think so, too. It's been really cool.
It has. I've really enjoyed this conversation. And again, for the listeners, thank you for bearing with us. I hope you have enjoyed it. The book, again, The Demotivated Employee, Helping Leaders Solve the Motivation Crisis That is Plaguing Business, by Drs. Kathy Bush and today's guest, Dr. Tara Peters. Again, I want to stress this. Please go get a copy of this book. If you are in a leadership position, I don't care where you are in the organization, this book is something that you are going to find value with, and I believe will be a quick reference guide that you're going to want to keep within in hand's reach at all times. But Tara, you know, we've covered a lot. And again, like I said, I think we could talk about a lot more. And maybe we look at having you back on, maybe you and Kathy, or in the future.
We would love to do that. We're actually doing that with Jay Izzo. So we'd love to come back and join you. So
absolutely. Well, yeah, definitely. We'll have to make that happen. But is there anything that we didn't get a chance to cover today that you would like to touch on before we close out?
You know, really, I think we touched on everything. The only thing that I would say is that really we have written this book to be a help. We really believe in you. We believe in leaders. And we know that each of us wants to be better and to grow. And so that's why we've written this book, to help leaders to be more effective in their roles. We've identified specific behaviors, so things that you can actually do that will help your people. And then we've carved out this space and time where we think it's really important for you to be able to reflect. And then at the end of the book, we actually provide you with a leadership development plan template that you can actually work towards in terms of your own personal growth. And so I just encourage you, Kathy and I just encourage you to develop yourself and to invest in yourself. And what a great time to do that right now as we're navigating the changes and the challenges that COVID has presented us with. But I firmly believe, Pat Lencioni said this, that we can emerge stronger and better from this time in our lives. And so I just want to encourage you to emerge stronger and better in this time.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. This has kind of forced us into our cocoon, if you will. And it's going to be interesting to see what people come out of the cocoon looking like, right?
Absolutely. And I'm excited by what that opportunity presents for us, and what it presents for your audience in terms of what they are doing and what their next steps might be professionally.
Absolutely. Well, Dr. Peters, on that note, if folks have, you know, they've hopefully have convinced themselves that they're going to go by the book now. They like what they've heard. They like what y'all are doing. How can they find out more about you? How can they contact you if they want to hire you to come work for their organization? And how can they get a copy of the book?
So they can go to our website, which is theleadershipdoctors.com. We are offering a special price right now on the book. It's on sale for $19.99, and so it's a great read. Also on our website, you will see a Lessons from Leaders interview series where we've been talking to leaders and getting their perspective taking during COVID. So that could be a great resource to you as well. So you can purchase on our website. If you purchase on our website, you'll get a signed book from either Kathy or myself. So that'll be great as well. So again, you'll go to the website, and then we ask that that you follow us on our YouTube channel. It's the name of our website, The Leadership Doctors, and then you can follow us on Twitter.
Outstanding. And I'll have links to all of those in the show notes so people can find them quicker. And I do encourage you to check all those resources out. Again, I really appreciate the time today. I really love what you ladies are doing. It's always nice to chat with like-minded individuals, if you will. Just keep it up, and thank you very much for spending the last hour or so with me today.
Well, thank you so much, Earl, for inviting me to be a part of your podcast and to have a chance just to talk leadership with you. It's been a great conversation, and really appreciate the opportunity to do so.
No, absolutely, absolutely. Listeners, again, thank you for sticking with us on this one. Really appreciate that. Appreciate the support. Make sure you're still going out there and liking and subscribing and reviewing and rating the show on whatever podcast platform that you're listening on. I say that on here all the time, but the way the algorithms work, the more of those we get, the more visibility the show gets, and the more guests like Dr. Peters and her colleague, Dr. Bush, get their message out there. And these are important messages to get widespread. So thanks for helping out with that. If you have any comments, questions, or concerns for me, burden.command@gmail.com, burden.command@gmail.com. Hit me with anything that you got there. If you got ideas for the show, guests, whatever you need, that's the best way to reach me. With that, I want to thank you again for being with us for the last hour or so. Thank you for your time, and I look forward to speaking with you again in the next episode.